I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for the sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire who are supporting our podcast. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any vehicle you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal, and you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, joined as always by John Rawling and Ian Dark, two of the voices of boxing. And this week, we are talking about the gents and their starts in the business, their inspirations in the business, and maybe there's one or two humorous anecdotes from over the years. John, obviously we've done a Boxing Life Stories episode in the past, so we have talked a little bit about this, but what was your first step from being into a serious employed role in broadcasting?
Well, I'd started as a weekly newspaper reporter, and then I started working for an agency which covered Leicester and Nottingham, which was a really good sort of sporting area at the time. There were two. It was not long after Brian Clough's team had won the European Cup. Leicester City had a decent side, two good cricket teams, and as well as that, there was a little bit of boxing around, notably Tony Sibson in that area. So I sort of started working in that and got into local radio, and then went from that to national radio. And then as soon as I got onto BBC Radio Sport, I was able to pursue my interest in boxing, which had really begun as a kid when Muhammad Ali was my ultimate hero as a boy. You know, he was just so charismatic. You looked up to him massively, and I was just hooked on the whole idea of boxing and everything about it. And as soon as I got the opportunity to work in boxing with BBC Radio Sport, then that's precisely what I did.
Who opened the door for you, John?
Who opened the door? Well, I tell you, somebody who held the door open. It's the guy we're talking to alongside you and me today, Ian Dark. I remember going down, and I'd always liked Darky as a broadcaster. I thought he had a real flair for it, and he brought warmth and humour to what he did. And I remember when I first started, Ian was already established as the main radio boxing commentator. And I started going down and doing a few interviews and meeting a few people. And then from there, going on to do the odd commentary. And Ian was immensely helpful to me. And I always remember one thing he told me. He said, you know, when you go along to a press conference or when you go along and meet people and talk about boxing, just assume that everything's a lie until you find out otherwise. Do you remember saying that, Ian?
Yeah, I do remember saying that. I think I was in quite a cynical mood that morning, but you know, there are. I'll take credit for launching the career of John Rawling, but I've probably got a lot to answer for, haven't I?
Yeah, that's you getting pelted on Twitter for the next couple of weeks, Ian.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, with me, I mean, like John, I had a background in local newspapers. I got fired from the first one on the Portsmouth Evening News because the editor hated anybody with long hair. So that didn't work very well. And then I got a job. Well, I struggled to get a job after that. I got a job on a weekly paper in Lincolnshire called the Stamford Mercury, where bewilderingly, I was made the chief reporter, which sounds really grand, but there were only three reporters. And the other two were even more inexperienced than me. So I had chief reporter on my CV, and I applied to BBC Radio Leicester for a news job, in fact, when it came up, thinking, well, there's no hope here. So I go for the interview. 200 people turned up for the interviews, and they said, oh, you're the chief reporter, and you're only 23. I said, well, yeah. I said, you know, it seems to have gone quite well so far. I said to him, I'd be very economic with the truth. And they said, well, that's pretty impressive. Can you do a voice test for us? So I did a voice test. And they said, there's a bloke called Adrian Just. He was this kind of really zany guy. You know, used to work, went on to work on Radio 1, did the voice test. He said, oh, that sounds all right. and I got the offer of the job. So somehow, so that's how I started in broadcasting. The only broadcasting I'd ever done before that was for the hospital radio in Portsmouth when I was a reporter there, and I got sent down to cover and commentate on a Portsmouth match. Right off the top of my head, alongside the local fire chief, who did it every week. So we did a whole season of commentating on these games. Found out at the end of the season, nobody'd heard any of them. There'd been some technical fault. So that was probably quite good practice for some Sky Sports box office middle of the night fights that we did later on, because I don't think that many people were watching half of those.
Oh my goodness! Well, that's great. And Ian, were you a Portsmouth fan at the time, or was that when you became a Portsmouth fan?
No, I was always a Portsmouth fan. I was born there. I was born next to the football ground in Portsmouth. My dad dragged me down there when I was five. And of course, they were a very good team in that era, or just before that. They'd won the title a couple of years running. So, I was hooked, really. So it spoilt a lot of Saturdays since.
Yeah, of course, of course. I mean, I've got to agree. Obviously, as a Saints fan, I don't know who's had the worst.
You and I shouldn't be talking to each other then, should we?
Well, no, we've had this before. Right. So, John, obviously, it's key that you have obviously someone to to open the door for you. But were there people that you looked up to away from obviously our learned friend down here on the Zoom call? Were there people that you really admired?
Well, I grew up loving radio sport. So when I first went down and worked in London, I was alongside people who were just voices who you'd heard, who in radio terms were legends. People like Peter Jones and Brian Butler, the football commentators, Peter Bromley, the radio commentator, Ian Robertson, the rugby commentator. And there I was, you know, rubbing shoulders with these people, and they were all to a man, people who I'd massively admired. Just before I sort of developed that one, I also remember back in my formative years, working for a guy in the Midlands called Roland Orton, who was an amazing character. Ian would remember well. I mean, Roly was very much of the persuasion: if there's nothing to do, go to the pub. Have fun, let's have a laugh. But on the other hand, if there was something needed doing, you work 24 hours, if need be, to get the story, get it done, and get it away, as he used to say, and file it to the national newspapers or the radio stations or wherever you went as a freelance. And that was really a really important thing, because one of the very, very most key things of what we do is actually meeting a deadline. If somebody says do something at 1 o'clock, you do it at 1 o'clock. And if somebody says, right, I want a minute, you need to do a minute to the second. And that's great training.
Yeah, Ian, how about yourself?
Well, if you want somebody really who influenced me as a broadcaster, I was lucky enough to work when Desmond Lynham was still at BBC Radio. So that's how I got the boxing gig, because Des was the BBC Radio boxing commentator in that era when I joined, and he was just making his big breakthrough at television. So he couldn't really do it anymore. So they said, look, why don't you have a crack at doing some boxing commentary? So they sent me down to the Albert Hall with a tape machine, because I love the boxing. So, you know, I tried to call these fights sitting in a box. They called it like a on one of those balconies at the Albert Hall, not a ringside. So I was calling all these undercard fights, you know, on Mickey Duff Promotions, putting them on the tape machine, taking them back to the office the next day for the editors and the bosses to listen to. And for about 20 weeks running, or the first 20 times I did it, they said, nah, it's not good enough. It's not good enough. Well, you've called that wrong. You know, then you've lost your way with that fight. And it was about 6 or 7 months before they finally said, yeah, I think you're getting there with this. We'll put you on one. So Des can't do this this one in a month's time. So you're on that. So that's how I first started doing the radio commentary. I mean, I failed and messed up a hell of a lot before they actually let me loose on the radio. But I used to go with Des to the fights. And I remember one of the very first ones I went to with him was that huge fight, you know, with all the explosiveness and stuff that went on around it between Alan Minter and Marvin Hagler when he came to London. And I remember going up to Hagler after the weigh-in, and Des was there and saying, could I just get a couple of minutes with you for BBC Radio? And Hagler, as he did, in the week of a fight barked back at me and just said, "You know I don't talk in the week of a championship fight. What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, it wouldn't hurt." I said, "Would he just to say a few words for us," like rather naively. And Des pulled me aside and said, "Never beg for an interview. You've asked him. He said no. You know, we don't go cap in hand." So I learned something there. And he was, I mean, you know, you everybody knows what a brilliant broadcaster Des was. And just to listen to the suave, easy way that he handled everything, you hope something of that might rub off on you. But I think if any of us get to be about as quarter as good as him, we'd be lucky.
Yeah, definitely. And I remember, so I've spoken to Mike Costello about his journey into broadcasting, obviously mostly on radio, and obviously now he's working for DAZN. John, so Mike told me that he had voice coaching and he wanted to have a certain style and a certain presence with his voice. You both have very distinguished voices, John and Ian. John, firstly, have you had any voice coaching or anything like this, or is what you see what we get?
No, you just work. I always just sort of worked it out as I went along, and you I guess you develop a style, and nobody ever complained about my voice. So I just sort of stayed with it. I mean, I remember as a young lad when I first started doing this, to actually get the idea of broadcasting and talking, I used to do it when I was driving. I'd be driving along and I'd make myself talk for 2 or 3 minutes about what I could see in front of me. And if you can do that and make it sound half interesting and actually keep it going, that's what broadcasting is. You know, people say, what's it like? How do you, well, when you leave a message on an answering phone, that's about as close as it comes to what radio broadcasting is about. And it's descriptive, but it's also entertainment, and you try and get some humor in as well. I mean, I always think it's a big mistake when people are too po-faced about it, because you're trying to describe sport, which itself is fun. So you don't want to be sitting reading a great plethora of notes in front of you and chapter and verse from previous records and previous fights. You're trying to describe the action and trying to make it sound fun, and I think that's what a few commentators forget.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing I've always remembered, I mean, I listen to people talking about broadcasting, you know, in a bar, having a drink and just getting a feel for it. And one of the great bits of advice came from, you know, the late great commentator Brian Moore, who said, always remember you're a guest in somebody's living room, which is, I think, is a wonderful piece of advice, really. And you're not talking to millions of people. You're just talking to one-on-one. Which is the relationship? It's between you and every single person that's listening to it. So I think over time you develop and start to realize that the broadcast needs to obviously be accurate, but it needs to have gears. It needs to have light and shade. There needs to be an interaction with the co-commentator. And I think in the case of covering sport, there needs to be an empathy and understanding of what those sportsmen are doing. So in boxing, in the ring, you wouldn't judge or have a hard-hitting verdict on a guy who's just starting out in his first fight or second fight. So I always judged fighters really about where they were in the pyramid. So, you know, with a prospect who they were hyping up, you might have a slightly harsher way of looking at it than a journeyman who turned up every week and, you know, had 200 fights and lost most of them because he was just there to be the opponent. So you gauged it really coming at it from that way. But that thing about having gears, I think, is a big thing. And what John said about warmth, I think warmth is the most underrated quality there is, really, for a broadcaster.
Well, I know. I think talking about gears, Ian, I think about the Fury Wilder fights. You know, they were very exciting. The first fight, though, was you know, it wasn't the most remarkable, but that last round was just incredible. And yeah. You do. I remember just sort of stepping up stepping up a gear. And Barry Jones said afterwards, he said, I think that was the best 3 minutes I ever did because I didn't say anything. I said, I just sat back and let you go with it, describing that amazing knockdown and him getting up when everybody thought he was going to be down for 10 minutes. And that's a typical moment when you move on a level. And you've had plenty of those. I mean, I remember one of your first big radio commentaries was Hagler and Hearns, and you said to me afterwards, you know, was I over the top? Did I go just too far? And I can remember saying to you, no, it was sensational. You know, I was sitting listening in the early hours of the morning, and it was just mesmerizing. You know, you really felt as though you were there, and that's the definition of a great commentary. You know, you had I can't even remember who your co-commentator was. Was it Colin Hart?
Yeah, it was the great story because the first round was so good, was so, you know, fantastic, really. Probably, you know, you could say was maybe the best round of boxing ever. Can argue that one. But for the only time ever, Colin Hart was sitting alongside him. He couldn't talk at the end of the round. I mean, he was just absolutely lost for words. And it's a great bit of radio because there is this gap. And then he said, he kind of gulps and says, I can't believe what I've just seen, you know? Or something like that. And I mean, I listen back to that commentary now and I kind of hate it because it is kind of frenetic and mad and manic. And the funny thing was that wonderful fight, I got a letter from an amateur boxing coach in Kent when I got back saying, dear Mr. Dark, I very much enjoyed the coverage of the fight on the BBC. However, for future reference, it is important for you to point out to us what punches were slipped or parried. And I said, so I sent him a letter back saying, have a look at the tape. There weren't that many punches being slipped or parried.
That's terrific. And obviously, you guys have been doing it for plenty of years. In fact, John and I were trying to work out off camera what our total time ringside is between the three of us. And it's obviously several decades. But John, when the red light goes on and you're recording, is there still a sense of nervous excitement and anticipation? And were you terrified at the start with the pressure of being live?
Yes, I think the first time you ever go before a microphone, you are terrified. I mean, the first thing I ever did was to read some racing results. And I remember there was a guy on the local radio, a man called Dennis Coath, who went on to work for Central Television for many years. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. He said, nobody's listening anyway. And then another time I was sitting reading the bloody racing results. He reaches across and sets fire to them. trying to read the racing results, which are literally going up in smoke.
I mean, do you remember we used to read the racing results? We had to record them because you had to know how long they were going to take when John and I worked at BBC Radio. And of course, a lot of the names are really quite difficult. You know, some of them are like, you know, Gaelic names or something. You have no idea how to say them. So quite often recording them, we would stumble on a name and then have to re-record it. And then everybody get a fit of the giggles. Corpsing, as it's known in broadcast, you just couldn't ever get it done. We'd be in there half an hour just recording the racing results from two meetings.
I remember once on Sports Report, one of the great gigglers of British broadcasting was John Inverdale. I mean, he was a shocker for corpsing. And I was reading the racing results, and I got one which won. The horse was called Roger the Butler. And the pair of us just went, you know, there were literally tears coming down our faces, and this was live on air. It was like Aggers and Brian Johnston when, you know, he can't get his leg over, and that's all. It was that sort of stature.
We had a problem one day with a horse called, I don't know why, we all started giggling, a horse called Baby Loves Smarties. I don't know why. we just every time we came to it, we so to at Kempton 2:30 number 5 Baby Loves Smarties. So, and you know, I mean, there are a million stories like that, but I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the main thing is that you're having fun, I think, because that comes over, I think, on the broadcast as well. I mean, John said it earlier, it shouldn't be this po-faced, sort of super serious, the way through, because that can be a bit relentless and difficult to listen to. So if there's a chance, without forcing it, to lighten it up and have a little bit of a chuckle, you know, so much the better.
The best co-commentators are those who are like that, because you bounced off them so well. You know, you had a great relationship for many years with Glenn McCrory. I guess I was, you know, Duke McKenzie, but particularly I think Barry Jones. You know, we used to spark each other off and make it a lot of fun. And I think if you can laugh on air, I think that really draws the viewer in, because they feel as though that they're there with you. I remember there was a radio broadcast, a good friend of Ian's actually, called Gary Richardson, and I remember him saying that to me at an early stage. He said, it's really good that you can find fun and have a laugh, because that gives a warmth, you know, and it engages the public.
Yeah. Do you remember Darren Corbett, who was a big Elvis Presley fan?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. And he used to do, I think, some Elvis impersonation. So he was in, I mean, sometimes I think, particularly if it's a dull fight where every round's the same, you do need to lighten it up a little bit. So he was in this pretty dull fight. I can't remember against who one night. So Glenn and I started going into all these Elvis references, you know, these terrible double entendres. And I said, yeah, I think it's probably now or never for Darren now, you know. And so he said, and Glenn would come and go, you could never question his heart. He hasn't got a wooden heart. So, and so he came to the decision at the end. And I said, well, you never can be sure how these fights are going to be scored, but I guess we can't go on forever with suspicious minds, Glenn. It's a truly terrible commentary, but I mean, we had a lot of fun, and I hope the people watching it might have.
Yeah, of course. I think that's the thing, and that sort of thing's contagious. You'll probably have people at home. You talk about the chap from the amateur boxing club writing into you. There'll probably be, in today's day and age, there'll probably be Twitter threads adding to your commentary with different ideas and different suggestions. Ian, let me ask you this. When you did the radio stuff, did you feel like you could hide behind radio and you weren't so exposed in the sense of not putting yourself out there as much, in the sense that, you know, you weren't out there in the public eye as much, not in terms of your profile, but in terms of, you know, people can't see you and can't see what you're doing. Did you feel like there was a wall of protection by doing radio?
Yeah, I mean, because in TV, that's true to some extent, because on television, of course, people can see the fight and they might think you're not even calling it right. But radio and TV, particularly in boxing, very different, because on the radio, you're very much, well, you're only the eyes and ears of the people who are listening. So you've got to tell them and try to describe and keep up with the action and give a sense of who's winning the fight, you know, blow by blow almost. That's what it's meant to be. And then the summarizer comes in the minute between and does the analysis. So it's a very different art from radio to television. No, I wouldn't say that you feel under any less pressure doing it. You still have that thing with boxing. It's quite, well, it's not unique. There are one or two other sports as well. But of course, you know, in football, you know what the score is, and rugby and cricket. But in boxing, you don't really know how the fight's being scored, but your job is to give the people who are listening or watching some idea of who you think is winning, and they're probably going to hold you to account afterwards if you've led them up the garden path on that.
Probably, absolutely, definitely. That's one of the great joys of social media, isn't it? You know, everybody has an opinion. If they don't agree with you, you get absolutely pelted, but I guess it goes with the territory. But I think there is a huge difference, because television, you cannot state the bleedingly obvious. You know, you have to add to what's actually is being seen. So that's where the chemistry between you and your co-commentator hopefully makes it that bit more entertaining for the viewers.
I think it's one thing that can happen, and I found we're talking about scoring with a fight, is nobody's to blame for this, but you've got two people. So if I'm working with, was working most of my career with Glenn McCrory and then, you know, later Jim Watt, you can almost be lured into their view of the fight. And you sometimes might need to be a little bit independent of that. And one fight springs to mind with this, and that was the one between Nikolai Valuev, the man mountain bloke, and David Haye. And Jim was kept saying in the fight, it was a perfectly valid point. He said, well, I don't think, you know, David Haye's really doing enough to rip away the title from this guy. And he kept saying that. And about the eighth round, I thought, yeah, but I think he's probably nicking the rounds. And so I came back at him and said, okay, you think Haye's not doing enough to rip away the guy's title? I said, but what's Valuev doing to keep it? So I think that kind of interplay is important as well. And you need to retain a sort of independence of spirit and not just it becoming like a mutual agreement where you get it presented that both guys think the same thing about the fight or persuade each other that that's what it is. I think you always have to retain that, your own view of it, and bring new elements into it.
Yeah, John, have you ever had that when you've been live with a broadcast colleague that springs to mind here, that where you've seen a fight differently to them?
Yeah, it has happened early on. I mean, Henry Cooper wasn't a great Frank Bruno fan. And I remember when Bruno fought McCall, Henry thought McCall had won that fight. And he was sort of giving that. And you know, he was a legend, but I thought differently. And I kept along with, the Bruno story, if you like, because in my opinion, he was winning the fight. And although McCall did come on strong in the last two or three rounds, I thought Bruno had done enough earlier on in the fight to take it. And so it happened. You have to be your own man sometimes. I think sometimes co-commentators can be guilty of wanting fights to be according to the script that they used to follow. So if somebody had a very good jab, you know, sort of the keep it long idea, if somebody had a very good jab, then they're sort of expecting everybody to fight like they did. And I don't think that's great commentary ever, because you get somebody like, for instance, Ricky Hatton. His strength was to roll inside, step to the side and deliver those tremendous left hooks. And that's a very different sort of style. It's more a Mexican style. And that's one of the reasons Ricky turned over to professional boxing so young, because he reckoned that style wasn't rewarded by amateur judges. So you have to tailor your view of a fight according to each fighter's speciality and strengths.
You mentioned Henry Cooper there. He was the first guy I ever worked with doing boxing commentary, because he was the regular BBC radio co-commentator. I mean, what a lovely, lovely, lovely man and very popular. But he could sit on the fence a little bit between the rounds. So you'd finish doing the commentary on a round and Henry would go, yeah, well, I don't know. It's like you said there, Ian, in the first half of the round, he got a few of those left hooks away. And then, but later on, he's come back with his jab and I think he's about even. It is another even round. So I remember doing one fight with him and I had to say after about eight rounds, I said, Henry, we've got six even rounds out of eight here so far. I said, who do you think's winning? So, I mean, but talking to Henry, I mean, reminds me of a great April Fool we did when we worked at BBC Radio. I said to him, because it was about the time George Foreman was doing his second coming, you know, the second bit of his career, you know, as a pretty old fighter. And I said, how about, Henry, you pretend you're going to make a comeback? I mean, and he did it brilliantly. So I did this interview with him. I said, what's given you this idea? He said, well, I've seen what George Foreman was up to in America. And, you know, I've kept it quiet, but I don't like flying much, but I've flown over there and I did a bit of sparring with him. And I thought, yeah, the old jab still works. I felt pretty fit enough. And I think I'm going to give it a go. You know, I don't see any point, any reason really why I can't get in with George for real. You know, we put this out on the radio on April Fool's. When I got a phone call afterwards, got back to the office, it was a Sunday Mirror saying, oh, we got a back page lead here, can you give us the tape, can we hear that again? I said I said, listen to the back announcement of it. I said, it's being that fight being promoted by Fighters of Old Limited. That's F-O-O-L.
talking of the Sunday Mirror, that just reminds me of another one which Ian and I were both involved in. I mean, people listening to this probably think you guys were just having fun all the time rather than taking it seriously. And I have to confess that a lot of the time that's precisely what we were doing. But do you remember him with Cedric Kushner, the old South African promoter who was a very, very large man with a walrus moustache, who a real sort of lugubrious character. And he talked a little like this. Yeah. Hello, I have a piece of him. I'm a boxing promoter. Anyway, he's got that sort of voice. And Ian and I conned on, and there was a guy from the Sunday Mirror who swallowed the story, hook, line and sinker, that Cedric Kushner had done the vocals for the Monster Mash. Remember that?
Yeah, well, that all comes, the press conference for Prince Nassim Hamed and Cesar Soto in Detroit. And we're all sitting there. And I remember Cedric Kushner had been brought in, hadn't he, as a sort of, you know, stopgap promoter. There'd been some issue with who was going to promote the fight. So he was sitting there with Barry Hearn at the front. And me and John Rawling, the aforementioned, are sitting at the back at this press conference. And Cedric Kushner starts talking. He goes, well, welcome to Detroit. And we're glad we're all here at last. And we seem to have the fight on. It will be Prince Nassim Hamed in defense of his title against Cesar Soto. So as he's talking, John turns to me, like that old record about the Monster Mash, and says, I was sitting in my office late one night when I decided to promote a Hamed fight. So I'm bursting out laughing.
It was the mash. It was the Monster Mash.
We're both absolutely lost in fits and giggles at the back. And Barry Hearn stops the press conference and says, Darkie, he goes, Rawling, do you want to share the joke with us? What's so funny? And we're going, no, it's okay. It's
oh, that's terrific.
I mean, John's right. We did have a lot of fun, but of course we did it all seriously as well. But you need that. I mean, when you look back on your career covering these fights, it's often, you know, the social side of those trips. You'll know as well, Tris, it's the social side of the trips that you remember as well, because we're stuck with each other for a long time on these trips. We'd get there, you know, because we had to do countdown shows and previews. We'd be in Las Vegas for, you know, best part of a week before some of these fights.
Yeah, so guys, obviously when you talk about these countdown shows as well, that's a different area of broadcasting altogether, really. And Ian, let me start with you on this one. Is, you know, obviously I've done bits and bobs of TV and nowhere near as experienced as you guys, but it's one thing being a pundit on a TV show and a guest, or even, you know, if you're co-coms and you're sharing that with something else. But when you're presenting down the barrel to camera, and even if you've got a small crew of, you know, a couple of audio guys, a couple of cameramen, a producer, people that you're not very familiar with, and then you obviously think about, you know, this is going back to thousands, if not for you guys, millions of people back home. It can be quite an intimidating thing. It's far different from just having a chat about boxing, isn't it? When you're actually looking down the barrel and trying to pin everything together.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you're the one who's got to stitch it all together, has got to bring in the guests who you've got with you, and make sure as well that it runs to time. I mean, quite often when we were doing fights in America, I can picture myself outside Madison Square Garden in the freezing cold doing Prince Nassim Hamed Kevin Kelly fight, and we were having to do all the live inserts with me linking them on the sidewalk, as they called it, outside Madison Square Garden. And of course a huge crowd started gathering around us watching us do this, and kind of pushing in, trying to get their faces onto camera. There wasn't too much we could do about it. And I was in my headphones while I was listening. You get, there's a technical thing called mix minus. You often get when you're trying to broadcast from America. Everything I was saying, I was hearing back through my headphones another 3 seconds later. So this was pretty difficult to do. Not only that, there was a bloke beside me. So I'm talking to Cameron saying, this is the famous Madison Square Garden, of course, and everybody will remember, you know, March the 8th, 1971, you know, the so-called fight of the century, Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali, right, you know, right here at the Garden. And this guy beside me, I can hear him, this New Yorker standing, I'm trying to broadcast, and I'm hearing him, he's standing right beside me, he's going, you hear what this limey said? He's going on about the fight of the century. There were better fights than that in the Garden. He goes, I used to go to them all. The limey thinks Ollie Frazier was the best. Like, I wouldn't put that in the top three. And he's, this is almost coming out on my microphone as well while I'm trying to talk. And that's just some of the things you're up against. I mean, another time we're on the boardwalk when John Rawlings in the background doing his usual trick of trying to put us off while we're live. Another time, a bloke ran up while we were talking about Lennox Lewis from nowhere in front of the camera while we were live and shouts out, Lennox is going to fucking murder him, and ran off. And I could have had to kind of look around and go, well, as you can see, everybody's got their own views of the fight here.
What can you do?
Those were often the kind of situations we were put in. So yeah, I mean, to take your point, Tris, yeah, it's different when you're the guy who's got to hold it all together. If you're just the pundit who's being hired, well, you answer the questions and that's all you got to worry about.
I don't know about you, Ian, but I always have found live broadcasting that little bit easier, I think, than recorded broadcasting, because when you're live, you're going by the seat of your pants, and you're having to get it right. Whereas if you're recording, you know, you get the false starts, you sort of think, oh no, that's not right, and before you know where you are, something which should be taking 2 minutes is taking 20 minutes because you've had so many restarts trying to get it right. Whereas if you're live, you just go for it and it's done.
Yeah. Absolutely right. That's right. I mean, we used to have a producer. They'd say, okay, we need four pieces that they've got to send back down over the satellite. But he'd always forget what one of them was. And so, you know, you'd packed up all the gear and be walking. It'd be pretty hot out there somewhere and walking down the afterwards. And he'd go to you, there was one other thing. So I nicknamed him Columbo in the end. He was like... One other thing, sir. We got one other piece to do.
So, obviously, I mean, you know, I mentioned there about the nerves and that kind of stuff. It's something that I really struggled with when I did a bit of presenting for BT in terms of, you know, the camera comes on and, you know, you got nowhere to go. I think there was a famous clip on YouTube. I'm not sure which American referee it was. Maybe it was Chuck Jamper. I'm not sure. But the camera goes to him, and I think he was sort of being tried out by Showtime for a piece. And he just freezes. He literally can't get anything out. It just, you know, it's an absolute car wreck. But I think we probably know those emotions of the fight or flight sort of thing of as to which way you're going to go. And obviously you guys thrive in it. John, you've not only done this stuff to camera, but you've hosted, certainly for Frank, I think, several press conferences. How's that been in comparison to broadcasting? Is it similar at all when you're trying to hold a room together on a stage?
Yeah, it's there are similarities actually, because what you're trying to do is to provide a platform for the fighters and the personalities, maybe the trainers, to actually say something and describe themselves and describe what the fight's gonna be. And I mean, there's a skill in that. You see some people do it not particularly well, and it can be an absolute mess. What you're trying to do in those press conferences is trying to sort of develop a story which those watching, the journalists who've come along and the people with their tape recorders and cameras who are doing television and radio, you're trying to develop a story and give them ideas about directions that their previews of the fight can go. Sometimes people are more cooperative than others. Let's put it that way. Sometimes people are naturals, are very, very good at it. You know, I think about people like Josh Warrington and Carl Frampton. I did a tour of the UK building that fight up, and they were an absolute delight to work with. But you get others who are just monosyllabic, and it's very, it can be very difficult. That can be, you know, it's literally almost like getting blood from a stone. It can be a very testing sort of examination of your broadcasting skills.
Yeah, I've got to say, I was asked once or twice to do this, and I said no, because I'm not sure, and maybe we can have a nice discussion here, John. I'm not sure ever that the commentator should be doing this, because you become a little bit part of the promotion, don't you, if you're doing that?
I
know it's the current way, and I'm being an old fogey, bit of a dinosaur here, and you know, and everybody's got a living to make. But it's not something I'd have ever wanted to do, really, to be fronting the press conference. I think that's the promoter's job to sell his fight.
Yeah, I hear what you say with that. I mean, we how many times have we sat in Las Vegas and listened to an hour of Don King before we got onto anything of value?
Oh yeah, they were shocking. They were the worst press conferences ever. Those ones.
Sweepstakes on how long Don would prattle on for.
Yeah, that's what kept it interesting, wasn't it? And usually about 53 minutes would be the answer, wouldn't it, before they ever got to Mike Tyson or whoever was fighting.
Well, the modern sweepstakes are now how many times people thank Al Heyman. That's where we're at with boxing now in terms of press conference sweepstakes. But yeah, I think that's interesting. And John, I kind of get what Ian's saying, in the sense that obviously you want that impartiality, but also at the sense... you know, there's no better seat in some ways if you're commentating on the show than to be front row and center with these guys. So you get a little bit about maybe what they're like on fight week that you can take with you into the broadcast as well, perhaps.
Yeah, well, that would be my justification, I guess. I mean, obviously you get paid to do it, and that's very helpful when you're trying to earn a living. But I think by being up there and talking to them and hearing them speak, you do get to understand them that little bit more. And I think that's useful, because when you're commentating, one of the things that you're always trying to do is just drop little anecdotes into what you're saying, and also quotes that you've heard during the week, because you can't just sit there reading out records and who their mother and father were and, you know, where they fought as an amateur. There's a lot more to it than that. And I think if you do that, I hear and I respect what Ian says about that, but I think you also do gain quite a lot.
Yeah, I understand that. I get that. I mean, my way of doing it really was I would try to hang out just around the two camps throughout the week and be just a bit of a sponge, just hang around it in the background and have chance conversations, you know, with trainers, assistant trainers, maybe even sparring partners. And then you just pick up the odd little tidbit, or maybe just the feel of things. And then, you know, you might go and have a drink with John and the journalists in the evening somewhere, and you'd maybe swap a few of those stories. And it was funny how often during a fight, something that you'd talked about in the week would come up that maybe wouldn't be part of the expected narrative ahead of that fight. And I think here's another thing. I think, you know, if you were giving advice to any young commentators starting, you make your notes for the fight. Of course you do, the records of the two fighters and so on and so forth. And maybe a few of the things that had happened in the past and antecedent, but never go in there and commentate on the fight you expect to see. Commentate on the fight that actually goes on in front of you, because quite often it's a tale of the unexpected.
I couldn't agree more with you on that. There's one or two people, and I'm not going to name names because that would be unprofessional on my part. But you hear them commentating, you can tell that they're just sitting reading pre-prepared notes, pre-prepared lines, and you sort of think, for God's sake, man, watch the fight, talk about the fight, stop reading your notes.
And often, it's changing in front of you, isn't it? Sometimes even within a round, something that happens, and if you watch. If you watch 1,000 fights, you start to pick that up a little bit, how the mood and the dynamic in the fight has just switched. And I think you've got to be fast on that.
Hearty once told me about a fight he did. Again, I better not name the name, but he did a fight over in the States. And he said that the commentator involved was sitting there reading his notes. and the fighter had literally chinned somebody and was about to go down, and he's still reading his notes, and Hardy's sort of almost having to thump him and to pull the notes away, pointing at the ring, saying, you know, literally he was wanting to say, look at the fight, look at the fight.
Yeah. I mean, the toughest fights to call. I mean, if you were setting a little test for a would-be wannabe boxing commentator, I wouldn't give him a thriller, you know, where it's all action, because a lot of people could sound good on a thriller because it's giving you so much. I'd put them in a studio and give them a very, very dull fight and see what they could make of that, how they might be able to make that entertaining or keep raising talking points within it to try and keep it interesting. I mean, some are really beyond that. I mean, a couple of Johnny Nelson's fights we did, I think that one with Waring, I mean, that really would have tested the ingenuity of any commentator. I think I said at one point in that, it's a close run thing, whether this is more interesting than the shipping forecast.
Well, yeah, I think you know, to be fair, Johnny would agree with that for the Waring fight and of course the DeLeon fight, which was historic in how terrible it was. Hey, let me ask you this, though, and Ian, I'll start with you on this one. You have both mentioned about times where you've had to judge a pace. So, Ian, you obviously came out the gates for Hagler Hearns, all guns blazing. And John, you had to sit back and wait for the end of the fight for Wilder and Fury. Ian, it's very difficult when you've got no idea where a fight's going to go to know how much you need to hang back and how much you need to push on with the commentary. It's not like a 1500 meter race where you're building to that final lap every time. You never know when the end is going to come.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think that just comes down to give you a very short answer here. That's just a question of feel and experience. And the other thing I'd say is always build yourself a bridge back. Because you can go too hard, maybe down one line, or even on the how you might be scoring the fight, thinking one guy's really nicking every round. But you're never quite sure, particularly here in Vegas, how the judges might be reading this. I remember, you know, on that outrageous Lewis Holyfield draw in New York. And we were calling Lewis the winner all the way through. But I did say about the sort of end of the ninth or 10th round, I said, but remember, we're talking about this is a Don King promotion, you know, in America. We don't know what the judges are seeing. And we've been shocked many, many times before. So I said, let's not count our chickens here. So that proved to be quite prophetic, as it turned out. Yeah,
we get a few stinkers in Britain.
Beatrice, really.
We get a few stinkers in Britain, don't we, on the judging? I mean, of late, we seem to have had too many. It's not an American preserve. And but if you see something which is outrageous, as you did with the Lewis Holyfield, you have to say so, Ian, don't you? You know, if you have to say, well, I frankly cannot see how they've come to that conclusion.
Yeah, I think I said on one or two fights, you know, I don't know what book the judges were reading there. Another one was, do you remember Michael Brody and Willie Horine? I mean, I thought he absolutely robbed that night in Manchester. It was an absolutely shocking decision. So don't be frightened to rage occasionally as well.
It's funny. I mean,
I probably almost lost my temper once or twice. I felt that strongly about it. I remember seeing Harry Carpenter. Do you remember that? I'm going back to the 84 Olympics here, showing my age. But I remember Harry sitting there when Tillman got the decision in the semi-final. Because he was an LA fighter. And even the LA fans booed it against some Italian. And I remember Harry getting this red pen and putting it right through his notes and picking up the bit of paper, screwing it up and throwing it at the ring. I never saw him that angry. So, yeah, I mean, but I know that feeling. I've had it a few times myself watching it. And you see somebody robbed like that and you think, what is the point? You
know, I agree, Ian. I mean, I remember when I did Mayweather-Canelo, which is obviously far more recent history in Vegas, and the CJ Ross scorecard came out a draw. And I was just thinking, you know, how do I even justify this in next week's magazine? You know, it's just ridiculous. It's beyond ineptitude. It was terrible. One example, by the way, in terms of the commentary and the tides changing, it was quite funny. I'm not sure if you gents have ever seen it, but Mickey Ward's fight with Alfonso Sanchez, and it was before Mickey reinvented himself, really. And maybe that was what sort of triggered his career reincarnation or resurrection, at least. And he was losing everything up against Alfonso Sanchez. And Roy Jones was on color commentary saying he's one-dimensional, he's flat-footed, he's terrible. And 6 or 7 rounds, Mickey's getting his head getting his head boxed off. And then, of course, he had that equalizer that left to the body. And it was the most... it was the most flip-flopped example of commentary I think I've ever seen, from being absolutely down among the dead men to, geez, he's done it with one shot. It was basically the only shot he landed the entire fight. Fantastic. It's a great listen, you know, just to hear Roy Jones burying Mickey Ward for 6 rounds until that final final blow. But, John, that you know, talk to me about this pacing thing. So I do find this interesting. You know, so say you had a Hagler-Hearns. Obviously, as Darkey says, you've got to go off out of the blocks fast. But obviously, you also need somewhere to go, right? If it even gets better than that.
Well, pacing is absolutely vital. And you have to... we talked earlier on about gears. And when something is truly thrilling, then that's when you have to up the ante. And don't make it sound like World War III, when people are just tipping their toes in the water and finding out what the fight's going to be, because it's always one of the great joys of boxing. I mean, it's why I'm hooked on it, and why I think Ian would be the same. You never know what's going to happen. It's an old cliche, it only takes one punch, but my God, it's true, isn't it? Remember going way, way back to those fights which Colin Jones had against Kirkland Lang. You know, I mean, Lang was sensational, wasn't he? But then you get one punch and it all changes.
Yeah, and I think that's another reason why I never really wanted to go in too much for trying to overhype or oversell fights, because the drama kind of looks after itself, and you've got to tell it like it is. If it's a dull fight, you have to say that as well, because otherwise, if you're saying everything's great and, you know, you've got to watch it, it's going to be fantastic, blah, 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 people don't believe you when you get to something that really is, you know, right there at the top of the charts, like a Hagler-Hearns. You've got to have somewhere to go. So maybe you can make yourself a little bit unpopular with the producers and bosses and editors, because, you know, when I was at Sky Sports, yeah, for very good commercial reasons, when it was a pay-per-view fight, they wanted you to sell it on the countdown shows. So there was this kind of unspoken compulsion, really, to come on and promise the earth to people to try to get them to buy the pay-per-view. But, you know, I always shied away from that. I mean, I always remember we did a fight with Amir Khan, and who was the Salita? Do you remember that?
Oh, Dimitri Salita, yes.
Salita, yeah, who we'd seen a lot of times in America on undercards. And you know, he clearly wasn't ready or up to world level, despite the fact that they tried to sell him in America. So he was brought over. I mean, I knew what was going to happen. He was going to get blown away by Amir Khan. So, you know, I was doing we had the week there. So I settled on a line at the end, because I thought it probably would end in a round or two. And all I did say was, you know, we never quite know what's going to happen in boxing. We've seen, you know, upsets before, but I think what we can promise you is that Amir Khan might well produce something spectacular here, which I suppose is economic with the truth in a way, and made you feel that maybe it was going to be worth watching without actually saying it's going to be a kind of blood and guts thriller.
Well, that was how they brought Khan back from Prescott, wasn't it? Am I right in thinking that?
I think you're spot on. Yeah, from his shock defeat by Bradis Prescott, as if to underline what John was saying there about, you know, you never know. What was that, 54 seconds?
Yeah, well, and I mean, it could have been shorter had Terry O'Connor not given him the opportunity to get his senses back together, which he should never have been given.
Yeah. You do get a bit of pressure to sort of sell a particular way in which a fight is covered, though. I remember when I had my year or so, maybe a little bit longer, when I was working for Sky, we had the big Klitschko Hay fight over in
Hamburg.
Hamburg, that's right. And the fight was a bit of a stinker, wasn't it? Right, let's be honest. And yeah. before the fight began, somebody who is a very prominent man within the Sky network came up to me, and I'm just about to go live on air, and he says, "John, don't forget, will you? We're in the David Hay business." And I thought, what are you talking about? We're not in the David Hay business. We're in the boxing business.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, you know, if I'd gone and said, "Oh, David Hay, what a fantastic performance he's having. He's doing this, he's doing that," I'd have made an absolute fool of myself, wouldn't I?
Yeah. No, you've always got to commentate on fighter A against fighter B. And sometimes I'd end up in rows with one or two people because, you know, we used to commentate on all the undercard in case it was going to be needed to fill out the program if the main fight went short. So, I mean, some of the worst robberies were in those fights that I saw, where you'd have a prospect in with, you know, some old stager from Nobby Knobs gym who'd come in. And quite often I thought, you know, the prospect hasn't won that. He's not up to it. But of course, you know, he'd get the decision and be nodded through. And, you know, these were little minor outrages, I used to think, along the way. And sometimes a promoter might say to me, "Oh, you know, you're not giving our guy a fair crack of the whip there." I said, "Yeah, well, I didn't think he won."
so the Hay thing, I think, is interesting, actually. Sorry, Ian, if I just rewind there to what John was saying, because I remember that fight with Klitschko, and there was a lot of hype, and I know we did a Boxing News special issue for that, and people were wondering if David Hay was, like, you know, this new explosive heavyweight on the block and all the rest of it. There was a lot of excitement going into that fight. You know, there was questions about Klitschko's chin, and everyone knew about David's explosive power. So, you know, what would happen then? And obviously people thought David might be a bit chinny, having lost at cruiserweight to Carl Thompson and so forth. So there was a lot of balls in the air in terms of how the fight might go. But in the end, it was massively disappointing, and in more ways than one, because it was pouring it down. It was a damn squib. If a fight is just dull, but you've got to create a watchable spectacle, you can't just say, "Well, this is really boring, isn't it?"
Well, what you've got to say, you go back to what we were saying before. It only takes one. And you know, when you've got a fighter with the power of Hay, that in theory he could land a big shot at any time, and it could instantly become a different fight. So I think that's the way you'd cope with that. As we all know, with the 2020 vision of hindsight, you know, David never got into range, never landed the big shots, and Klitschko was never in trouble. But there was the possibility during the fight that he might do that.
He didn't really lay it all on the line that night, did he?
No, not at all.
Not until the press conference, when he got up on the stage and revealed his toe to the world.
Yeah. I mean, that was a bad night for David Hay, and quite a bad night for boxing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a shame, because it promised so much, and whether it was going to be the changing of the guard or just an exciting fight, it just really didn't deliver, which is a shame, because it was meant to be an iconic night for whoever won, really. And in terms of that, it was really just best left unsaid, really.
They don't all work, do they? It's about styles make fights, and sometimes you get classics like the Bo Holyfield fights and like the Wilder Fury fights. Sometimes they just gel. Other times, and that was the Hay fight against Klitschko was a really, really good example. The styles just don't work.
Yeah, you can never orchestrate the action as well. I mean, your job's to describe it and analyze it for people with the good help of your co-commentator. I mean, I always think the other thing is, you know, John and I could watch 1,000 fights, you too, Tris, but we'd never know quite as much as someone who's actually been in there and done it. They'll always see something more.
And let me ask you this, Ian, I'll start with you, because you've got one of the great lines in Boxing Life Stories, where you say, where you quote Frank Maloney, actually, who was another co-coms of yours at the time with the Bo Galotta riot when he said, I think Lou Duva's dead. And I think the amount of times that's been quoted to me on Twitter has been insane. But sometimes the thing you need to commentate about isn't what's in front of you. So obviously I'm talking about things like the fan man or whether there's fights in the crowd and the Galotta riot. Like, you're there to broadcast on an event, but you're actually having to report on a story.
Well, if there's a fight in the crowd, you can't just ignore it, can you? And when that, I was there when the fan man came down in Vegas at Caesar's Palace that time. You know, you were looking at it, and I remember there was a guy sitting next to me who was about 90 years old. This old American journalist, and he'd not said a word all the way through. And suddenly, this thing comes down from the sky, and he just said, he looked at it, and he said, what the fuck? Thank you for entering the description of the fight.
Well, I mean, the Bo Galotta thing was incredible. I mean, when you went outside, you realized how serious it had been, because there were police cars as far as the eye could see outside Madison Square Garden, stretching down 7th Avenue, and we got escorted out in the end via some underground tunnel that we didn't even know it existed. And yeah, I suppose let's repeat the story. Frank Maloney shouts out, I think Lou Duva's dead! Lou Duva's dead! I think reports of his death might be a bit exaggerated. I said, let's all calm down here. I said,
as you're shielding underneath the table.
We were commentating from underneath the table. I mean, another one I remember was in Stafford, it was, wasn't it? Where,
oh, that was a bad one.
Frank Tate and all hell was breaking loose. And I had to get Henry, who was working with us for radio, give him the microphone to try and get everybody to calm down. There were sort of gas canisters being thrown and what have you. And Henry got the microphone and said, come on, everybody, calm down. Come on, look, behave yourselves. Behave yourselves. Of course, they all did, because it was Henry. He was one man sort of stopping a riot. You know, it was on the front page of the Times the next morning. I think that was the headline, Henry quells riot.
Yes. Henry was brilliant, wasn't he? I mean, as your co-commentator, you'd walk through the crowd, and he'd be absolutely mobbed by fans wanting autographs and this, that, and the other. And you felt more like his minder than his co-commentator. And eventually you'd have to say, come on, Henry, we've got that interview to do. We've got to do that piece to get him away. You know, because it'd have literally been there for an hour or more signing autographs if we hadn't helped get him out of the building. But he was an absolute treasure. You know, you talk about national treasures as a man and as a co-commentator, Henry Cooper was one.
Yeah, lovely bloke. So,
I think as a parting shot, maybe in fact there's a couple of places, so maybe we'll have to pick this up actually. Maybe we should do a special just on co-commentators as well, which I think could be very interesting. I just wanted to get your take on this thing that we see often in the modern age, where you guys have to apologize for what's being said in the corners. Is that a strict Ofcom rule where,
yeah,
you know, you know, because it's a sporting show, you have to do this stuff by the book and it needs to be in there?
It is Ofcom, yeah. That's precisely why, Triz. I mean, you know, I find it pathetic and just ridiculous. You know, you're watching a boxing match where, let's be honest about it, the aim is to hurt the other guy and sometimes hurt them seriously. You're legitimizing that, and at the same time having to apologize because some trainer in the corner swears. And I find that ridiculous. But you know, if that's the rules, that's the rules. I once said on Box Nation, well, there's some pretty spicy language in the corner, but then again, we are watching boxing, and if you're offended by it, maybe you shouldn't be watching this sport.
Yeah, you're talking live sport, aren't you? So you've got your microphones going, so it's going to happen. And boxing's on usually pretty late at night as well, so it does seem unnecessary. If you watch fights on HBO in America, they never do any apologies at all. They just take it all as legitimate actuality and part of the show.
Yeah, that's another thing altogether about how late the start time of boxing has become over the years. I'm sure it never used to be sort of kicking off at about 11:15 at night which is a time when I'm reaching for pipe and slippers. But gents, this has been a lot of fun. I don't really know what I was expecting from it, but it's been absolutely terrific to go through some of these stories, and super grateful for your time and for the stories and the anecdotes. And I think there's probably more that we can revisit on this theme as we move forward.
Definitely. Absolutely. Definitely. You know, I mean, we've watched great fights, but we've had great times and we've had great fun and met great friends, you know, which we are and have been for many a year. And I hope we'll continue to be so for many a year from now.
Yeah. We had a lot of fun along the way. I'll give you one last story. I used to have an arrangement with John McDonnell when he was doing the emceeing, and to sort of bide our time, we'd have to try and I'd give him words he had to get into the introduction for a fighter, and he'd give me a couple of words I had to get into one of the undercard commentaries. So one night it was, I had to get pork sausages into the commentary. From Wolverhampton, I can't remember his name, and I said, just thinking about these fighters coming through. I mean, there was a time, I said, when they'd get sponsorship from maybe their local butcher who'd send them some pork sausages or steak or something. He said, I don't think that really happens anymore. You know, you have to make your own way.
Well, Ian, were there ever any stakes? Did you and John have any bets going on between you?
It was just a little fun arrangement we had. But I told him he had to call Sergei Devikov, smoking Sergei Devikov, when he introduced him that night. That was the quid pro quo, which he did. And here's the great thing. The next time Devikov fought in England, he fought a few people, didn't he? He actually came in a gown saying, smoking Sergei Devikov. I kid you not. He said, I like that nickname.
That's brilliant. That's the very definition of taking it and running with it, isn't it? That's brilliant. Guys, this has been a whole host of fun. Thank you so much for doing it. And thanks for joining me. I very much look forward to doing it again soon.
See you soon.
Cheers.
Goodbye.
We're grateful for the sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire who are supporting our podcast. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any vehicle you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal, and you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Check them out at fleetuk.com.